Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Do I need a top of the coffee before we crack on? Right. Before I try and get this intro, I'll probably have to do it 20 times.
You'll nail it.
You ready?
Yeah.
Energy.
Ha ha.
Welcome to our first After the Whistle podcast with me, Lewis Moody.
And me, Leon Lloyd.
And we're on a bit of a mission to try and understand what it takes to build a champion mindset whilst dissecting the roles that resilience, leadership and teamwork play in personal and professional success. And of course, the toll it can take on both your physical and mental health. And when that final whistle blows, what happens in retirement? Is it injury? What comes knocking? Well, I'm delighted to say that with us today is a rugby legend, a god of the game, you may say, having had over 200 appearances for Northampton, played 40 games for Brive, won the Heineken Cup in 2007, had 73 caps for England, 3 for the British and Irish Lions, won a Grand Slam in 03, won the World Cup in 03, broke his neck in 2007, which forced him to retire, came back from a broken neck, which is a remarkable story in itself, to play in the World Cup in 2011, went on to be England's most capped hooker. It is a pleasure to have Steve Thompson, MBE, in the room with us. Tomo, welcome, mate.
No, happy to be here.
Nice to see you, looking slightly svelter than the last time I saw you.
You're always using those posh words, Lou. that means
leaner.
Yeah, Leon. Yeah, I was going to say, Leon, can you just translate for me? Yeah.
I'll take it from here.
His parents are happy about some of the money they
spend. You're looking in good shape, mate. You're looking in good shape.
Trying to. I got really fat, though. I went up to 148 kilos, so...
148?
Yeah, it's about 23 stone, I think.
What are you now?
About 119. It was one of those things, I suppose, afterwards...
Why did you end up
with the injury again, because I broke my neck for a second time. Yeah. Well, moved to Dubai, got into life over there, eating, drinking a lot, and just didn't want to face going to a gym. You know, I tried to go once, and it was just, no, to be honest, I've had enough of that. And my body just didn't want to do it, and my mind didn't want to do it, which is the hardest thing. And so I've had a few years of chilling out a bit. I lost a load of weight and then needed to, you know, get back into normal life as such and working, and that caught up on me. And then now I thought, right, I've got to get back into it again. So I was back up to 148, so I'm coming back down again, and you know, the lifestyle change and everything's all there, and I wanted to keep myself healthy for the kids.
Fair play, mate. 148 kilos, that is, I think my heaviest ever weight was 110. I mean, I worry about getting a little bit overweight. 148, I mean, that is a lot of Cornish pasties for me.
I remember trying to get to, when I moved to the centre, I was too light and I kept getting injured. And I said, Dean Ryan said, we're not picking you unless you can weigh in at 100 kilos. And I couldn't get to 100 kilos. And I realised that before weighing, if I drank a shed load of water and also put stuff in my pockets, I got to over 100 kilos on the weigh-in. So I did that once in Portugal, got over 100, 100.7 it was. That's the heaviest I've ever been, but not genuinely over 100. Still got injured quite a lot.
I've always struggled weight-wise, as Lewis and everyone. I was always in the fat club. I was a lifetime member for that. Whatever rugby club you play in, you know, there's always a fat club. And I was automatically put straight into it. And, you know, I've always struggled with my weight.
Fattest, whoever it was. Yeah. You go back and have a word.
The worst one was at England when we used to be there, and you get weighed every single morning, but then as you go up, it's like a buffet type breakfast, and as you look up, there's like a green line of names, amber line of names, and then red, and mine was always in red, and it was like, you're not allowed to eat out of this container. So normally I'd go from sausages, bacon, miss all that, and then suddenly it was like lettuce and muesli. That was my sort of thing I could eat sometimes, and it's just one of that. I trained hard, I did look out at what I ate, and remember Matt Lovell?
The nutritionist.
He said I was the English version of a Samoan. So I had the body type of a Samoan, apparently. So
was that a compliment? I'm not sure.
Definitely not.
If you look at some of the Samoans now, that is a massive compliment. Yeah. I would love that. But mate, you had a stellar career. You know, you had some enormous highs and some lows, obviously with the injuries and what have you. But I want to go back to sort of a start and what early life looked like for Steve Thompson. You know, where it began for you?
Well, I was born Thompson, and then adopted over to Walter, and then changed my name back to Thompson later on. And
that's interesting. I didn't know you were actually born Thompson, and then
changed back. But I didn't start playing rugby till I was late. Just turning 16 was when I first started playing. Northampton School for Boys. Yeah. Mark Lee was a teacher there. I got myself into a lot of trouble as well. I was a bit of an idiot when I was younger, or a massive idiot. I was always basketball and football, and that was going really well. And I was really slim in those days as well. I was one of those tall, skinny lads. So everything was working out fine. And so I was one of those kids that, you know, came back after summer holiday and put on a couple of stone and grew a few inches and stuff. And he pushed me towards rugby. He told me, I can remember one of the second games I played for him, "You better listen to me, Steve Waddle, because I'm the best coach you're ever going to have." And I still get him for that as well. And
you still keep in touch with him?
Yeah. So it was the anniversary of the old Northamptonians, which is part of the Northampton School for Boys. So I went back, and he's retired this year as well. So I went back to see him that. And then on November 22nd, there's the old Northampton School for Boys reunion. So I'm going to go back as his guest and that. So I'm looking forward to that. And, you know, sometimes you've got to go back and during my career as such, I didn't probably thank enough people for what had happened. You sort of get in the middle of it. And now I'm trying to go around and go back and say, look, you know, you were a massive part of it. And like I said, I was an idiot when I was younger, and, you know, rugby sort of saved me as such, really. And, you know, he was the first person to do that for me.
When people look at athletes that succeed, sometimes you hear people talk about an event that happened in their younger years that galvanized their mental approach or focused them on where they wanted to get to. Did you have any event like that as a young person, or now that you reflect on?
No, just another person that looked after me, Keith Picton. You know, he's passed away now, God bless him. And he was the team manager at Northampton Saints. And when I went down there, it was one of them, if you caused trouble or you went out, you got kicked out of the weren't even academies then. It was like the Colts.
Yeah.
But he'd always look after me. And I can remember going on tour. I was 17, 18. We're going on tour to America.
With
Northampton. Yeah. It was like a development tour. And I can remember I couldn't afford to go because I was living on my own. All the other lads were, you know, living with their parents and stuff, and I wasn't.
Why were you living on your own out of interest?
I got kicked out of home. So I moved out when I was 16. It was just many things, just families as they are. You know, I don't speak to any of that now anyway. So I've sort of moved on. And he was one of these blokes. I couldn't go on the tour. I couldn't afford to because I was working and stuff. He got me a sponsorship, got me on the tour. And I can remember when we got on the flight, I was thinking, oh, I haven't got much spending money. He came over and got a few hundred quid for me and stuff like that. And so I could enjoy the trip. We went to Chicago, Columbus, Ohio. You know, it was an amazing tour. And it was like a real eye-opener because I'd never really been out in Northampton much, to be honest. And then suddenly I was on that tour, and suddenly it showed me a sort of another side of life and another sort of family. And that's what, you know, the Northampton Saints and Keith Picton and, you know, players that were there then became my family and sort of looked after me and things like that, and brought me up and gave me the sort of building blocks to become the person I became, hopefully.
I suppose that's where you get, you know, the family tie to rugby. I know that I know you've had a few clubs, which we'll talk about that a little bit later on. But I always look at you as a Northampton Saints. I remember when we first played against each other, you were back row, and then the game changed, and then the front row boys became even bigger. And then I remember hearing that, oh, Steve Thompson's moved to hooker. I'm like, absolutely no chance can a back row player move to hooker. And then you went on and then absolutely smashed it. But if I look back now, I still see you as a Saints player, because that's where you earned your stripes, if you like. You're there, and it's through key individuals like that, which I'm sure, Lewis, you've got, probably got some as well, and I know I have, that made it easier for me. And I suppose life-changing. You know, that sounds like a life-changing moment, going to America on that tour. That's what makes you feel like you owe the game, or sort of you feel committed to the game, and you see it in a different light.
You had Pete Lloyd as well,
didn't you?
Who actually took you to training, gave you a means of getting to rugby.
Yeah, helped me out. Very similar to what you said. I left home at 16 as well, again through arguments with parents. It's quite, when you're saying then, I was thinking, God, that's the same. It's pretty similar. And I left home at 16. I moved across, lived with Jono, and I got given this opportunity, which if I hadn't had people like Pete Lloyd and other those around me who saw the opportunity, and bearing in mind, you know, we're all the same age, the game wasn't pro then. So we weren't doing it for a career. We were doing it because someone helped us and saw something in us, and they just happened to turn into our jobs. So I feel very lucky to have those people outside.
I love the fact that you lived with Martin Johnson, the world's grumpiest human being. Oh, I love the fact that he actually gave you a room to live in. He would never do that, would he?
Some great conversations there.
That was great chat.
Morning. Yeah. Good night.
I remember walking back one night out. I was playing with the Colts. I came back in and he would hate me for saying this. I walked in and he obviously wasn't Martin Johnson that we know now. He was just Martin Johnson. This is 95, 96. And he was there watching lineouts. He literally came on a Saturday night. He was just watching different people getting different techniques for lifting people in the line.
Well, lifting would have only sort of just come in there, wouldn't it?
So I'd walked in. I may or may not have had a few beers and not thinking straight, thinking, oh, I can't. I've got to make sure I'm sober. And I walked in. I just sat down next to him, had a glass of water, and just watched him, thinking, oh my god, I've got to get out of this house.
He was doing line out analysis again for the 19th hour. But it's a good point to talk about. I know we're chatting about what people impacted us as young players or just young blokes coming through school or leaving home. Who were the characters in that Northampton side or that England side maybe that took you under their wing? Did anyone take you under their wing?
Yeah, big time. Tim Robber was the big one for me. I can remember one time we had the likes of Frederico Mendes, Gary Pagel, World Cup winner, Matt Dawson. But before games, he used to go around the team, and in big games, he used to go, right, Gary Pagel, World Cup winner. Then, I'd be at Hooker and he's like, Steve Thompson, you are going to play for England. And then like Frederico Mendes, who could play any position in the front row. So it was like an armchair for me when I first went to Hooker. Sometimes he'd start at Hooker, I'd be on the bench. Then he'd move to tight head or loose head and then I'd come on and to learn off the likes of them. But, with Tim Robber, he used to be able to talk you up and that. And he was sort of, a lot of people didn't like him as such because he was just hard. And I can remember one time I got pulled into training with the first team. There was one of the other lads. I was back row then, but one of the other lads, and suddenly Ian McGeeken see me coming down because the second team or the youth team and stuff like that used to train at the top pitch. And as you're walking down, they used to have a first team against second team on a Tuesday night, and it used to just be unbelievable. Just
carnage.
Yeah. So we used to stand there and watch, like, oh, look at that. And next minute, I get called, Steve, you're on. And I was like, I was only 18 years old thinking, no, can't be right. I'm not going to, you're on. So I was like, fine. First thing, I got punched in the side of the head. So instantly, I just turned around, got the rage, and just started trying to hit whoever it was as hard as I could. Next thing, literally skin in the back of my neck gets picked up, pulled to one side. Suddenly, I look up, and it's like Tim Robber. He just went, I like that. And that was it. Like, and that was me.
Baptism of fire.
Yeah. So sort of in. He took me under his wing. Sounds weird. He was like doing training sessions with me. He was always pushing me. And I never knew it. First time I trained for England, he said, look, you're coming down with me. So he took me into the car. We drove down to Peniel Park.
Was he still in the squad then?
Yeah, he was just in the squad. And for me, it was just a massive eye-opener. Like you said, it was to have someone like that, Tim Robber, you see, he was like the big man of the club. Suddenly for him to start sort of wanting to spend time with me and things like that. And I was just, this is unbelievable.
Do you think he'll realise that he's had that influence on you? Because obviously now you've gone on and achieved what you did and won a World Cup and everything else. Do you think he'll realise that how significant a part he had playing and you getting there, do you think?
I don't know. I hope so. If not, I want to try and see him. He's been away in America. Now he's back in the UK and he's sort of kept his head down, really, away from rugby. He's done. Everyone knew he'd do well. He's one of those characters. He was my club captain at Northampton, and he's one of those characters. If he'd ever turned around to me and said, right, I want you to get involved with this with me, and I wouldn't even question it. I'd say, yeah, I'm in. Because it's going to do well. Plus, also, I'd like to, do whatever I can to pay him back.
Do you think that straight-talking sort of approach that he had and that, didn't take any bullshit was a good way or helped him into that transition? He's now CEO of, I don't even know the organisation.
Yeah, he's doing really well.
He was an army officer, wasn't he? Yeah. He was an army officer, he's always a leadership, he had that Feck, or future England captain, that was his nickname for years in the England squad,
really?
Until he got sent off, I think, against South Africa.
It was a hell of a bunch up that, though. Yeah, I remember watching it.
And the bloke deserved it. he was going to be the England captain, and he was that sort of driven. He's quite sort of chalk and cheese. People either loved him or hated him because he is who he is, and he's just a leader, born leader, an alpha leader that's, just took no. And when you got characters in the squad, like Matt Dawson, people like that, who's suddenly bigger than life, everyone knows Matt Dawson now. You've got to be able to keep them in, like, canned in as such, like Jono did with Austin Healey and things like that. Let them free, let them express themselves as such. But then every so often, they didn't even need to give him a slap. They sort of just looked at him.
It's the look or the big finger. The frown comes over.
And Robbins are the same. He's just like the look, and suddenly you just see the colour just drain out of people's face. Like, oh, yeah, I'll be quiet now. And like I said, he's a massive influence in my rugby career.
It's a shame that he's not, I don't know what his involvement is in rugby now, but you look at those characters from back then, and you think some of them are destined to stay in the game and they've got the DNA of the Saints running through them, you think he'd be a shoo-in for a director or something like this. I don't know what he does now, but he sort of completely left the sport. And then now, you know, 10, 15, probably even 20 years later, now he's sort of back over in the UK. It's a shame the game loses out when those people don't stay involved, I think.
I would have thought you could relate to that, because I feel that, you know, when you left the game, you were seriously upset with the way you were treated, and you felt maybe a bit bitter towards the game. And actually, I feel like you've distanced yourself.
I have, yeah, but I don't remember Tim in that way. He was in the 99 World Cup squad, I think. I think he retired after that World Cup squad. So it wasn't like he didn't go out on a, you know, he didn't go out and win a World Cup, obviously, and retire that way.
But was in 2000, he was there too.
Was he still played after?
Well, yeah, he won the European Cup. Right. Obviously, he moved to second row. We won the World Cup in 2000, and I think he sort of retired just after that.
Not on a low point. So I know I have my own reasons for stepping away from the game, but I don't remember anything with him. But I suppose we've all got our own personal...
And that's the interesting thing about talking to people like Tom, isn't it? And hopefully, you know, maybe we'll chat to Tim in the future and understand the journeys that we've all been on and what happens when we finish.
I fell out of love with rugby, though. I've only just started to be able to watch it again.
Why was that? Because I know everyone's got their own reason. Was it injury? Was it just...
Well, the first one, when I got injured the first time in 2007, I was actually happy to get injured.
Why was that?
I just had a big fallout with Northampton, really. And I was leaving to go to France. Which I didn't want to do. You know, Northampton was my hometown, you know, the rugby club, but I just thought it totally changed. When you're under management and players like Matt Dawson, Tim Robber, you know, all this, and suddenly, you know, the clubs sort of run one way, you're under that, and then suddenly you sort of rise to the top as such, and you think, right, that's how it's going to be forever. So suddenly it's probably me being short-sighted as well. And, you know, you look at it and you think, It's not the way I'd like it to be run. This is my hometown club, and it was changing and things like that. And I really sort of hated it and just had enough of rugby. My body was battered. I can remember, you know, in 2004, so after the World Cup, I asked not to go on tour to New Zealand and Australia. Did you come on that one, Moodos, as well, where we got hammered by New Zealand and Australia? They were like really up for it. So we won the World Cup.
What year was that?
2004. I said my body's. I went from 2000 all the way.
I was injured. Yeah. Again.
I went 2000 to 2004 without missing any games. Really, I was never really got injured and stuff like that. And when I did get injured, I just got jabbed straight back on again. I think I had a couple of weeks off.
What do you mean by jabbed? Some people won't understand that.
Just injections, just to get rid of the pain as such. Like when I've done my ribs, my knee. They just sort of just jabbed that. And because I weren't a sprinter like Leon, do you know what I mean? It was just like man up and get back on the field and get those tablets down. You just get through training. If you don't train, you don't play. That was the mindset before.
Yeah. So you talked about, you know, getting a jab and just wanting to get out and play. And do you think any of the, you know, the supplements and all the stuff that you had to take and the things you were put through, has that had any impact on you now, like health-wise?
Or? Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, I went to the hospital last year. So I'm getting like stomach ache and stomach pains, and they're saying that some of my stomach's rotting, got ulcers, and they were saying it's from years of taking anti-flams. Yeah, you know, you used to turn up for training, you used to have your shirt, and then underneath used to be a couple of painkillers and a couple of anti-flams. Man up, let's get out there, you know, take the edge off. Whereas now it's, you know, it's good now, you know, the players are looked after, but perhaps we were the guinea pigs as such.
How do you feel about that now in hindsight? Because I know I've spoken to people about this before. And Leon, you know, you've obviously had tons of trouble with your knees that you always moan on about. Oh, my knees. But I look back and I think, do you know what? Okay, so I ended up getting ulcerative colitis. Like, you know, it sounds like you've got the start of something similar. And I put that down to the drugs. But I often look back and think, would I have done anything differently if I knew better? I don't know if I would, because I always wanted to play. And I think that if I didn't take him, maybe I wouldn't have been able to play. How do you reflect on it differently if you'd known the impact that all those anti-inflammatories might have?
Well, you hardly did play, did you?
Exactly, true. Mate, you did play a lot more games than me. Actually, no, I was looking at your stats. You only played a 240 Premiership games, I think. Was it 240, something like that?
Yeah, I played the Leeds as well.
Yeah, there's only seven more than me. You include the one game at Wasps.
Yeah, you've got to remember,
though,
I've had 2 years out, 3 years out with a broken neck from Premiership.
Yeah. I've got the world's smallest violin over here.
Look, come back to you.
But to come back to the sort of anti-inflams and stuff, would you have had a different approach, do you think, if you knew?
I think I wouldn't have taken as much if I'd have been educated about what it could do and just sucked up the pain, if I'm honest, because it was just... But you just... We used to call them the rugby player smarties. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? You just take them and, you know, and when you're young and that, you just, you don't really think what you're doing. You're sort of told to do it. We weren't educated, oh, if you take these, this is what the long-term thing. It was just like, take these and get out. Whereas I think perhaps, and you sort of, were we addicted to them? Perhaps we were, I think. Or perhaps not addicted. Did it just become a habit?
Yeah.
They're there, take placebo, them, get through it. Yeah, just, and you just keep doing it. And I think perhaps that's what happened. You know, it's one of those things that you get into and you just keep doing it.
Well, I was actually reading a very interesting article the other day on The Economist, and he initially started talking about the NFL, and there were 291 episodes, recorded episodes of concussion in 2017-2018. During that same year, that same period, the article went on to talk about in the Premiership, there are 18 concussions per every 1,000 hours of rugby played, which is, when you think about it, that's a lot of concussions.
That's a lot of concussions. Well, we played. I mean, we experienced that firsthand. But that's not only in the hours played; it's in the training as well. You know, you used to get the number of dings to the head. You know, the blurry eyes, all that sort of stuff that you could get that isn't necessarily considered concussion is now, thankfully.
And I think what's scary is we know that it happens, and you watch it on TV, and the players are getting bigger, and the game's getting quicker, and everything else. But when you actually see it written down in an article. That's what took me by surprise. You know, you actually see it written down.
You're sifting through the noise, aren't you, and just getting straight to the point.
It makes it real,
And it's fascinating as well. You know, I know you use The Economist because of your role at Switch the Play. You know, CEO of Switch the Play, and the amount of information and, you know, the stories that you need to get out there. It's not just, you know, obviously you've got the science, you've got tech, you've got arts, you've got all those other areas, and probably a lot of people wouldn't even know that sports is also a big area to be covered in The Economist. And how many have actually, all the stuff we've just spoken about there, all links to
all
sport anyway.
I think it's important now, it's just, there's lots of opinions out there in the sport, and their opinions are great and experiences are great, but sometimes you need evidence, you need facts.
Yeah, and The Economist is a smart guide to the forces changing our world, but don't just take our word for it. For your free print copy of The Economist, just text AFTER to 78070. That's text AFTER to 78070 for your free print copy.
Yeah.
You know, it's World Cup year now. We've covered various different things there, but we're going 2019. It would be totally amiss of us not to talk about 2003 and your involvement. Obviously, we shared a room at various stages during our career, and I had to put up with the horrific sight of seeing you walking around naked, oiling yourself up with various different creams.
I think that's called like...
Is that too much?
No, you're a bit like American Beauty, weren't you? You were there with your phone videoing me in the cupboard, you were.
It was in private. But we had some great times. But what are your memories of that incredible experience in 03?
It was amazing. That pre-camp was just some of the best times of my life, you know. And, you know, I hear a lot of stuff in the press now, controversial or not, about people saying, you know, oh, you know, they don't want to be in the England camp and all this. To me, that was the best time of my life, really. You're in that bubble, and it is a bubble. You know, let's be brutally honest, the real world's bloody horrible at times. And, you know, you look at it, it's, whereas you're there, everything's done for you, you're looked after. You were the lads. Some people, it's like anything. There's some lads you don't really like, but you get on with them just because you sort of have to, but you respect them.
We
had massive respect in that squad, you know, and that was a good thing. I was really lucky. I was one of the last pieces to come into that squad. I think you and Josh Lucy and
Benny Kay
came in from the America tour. I went on that America tour, just trained a lot and got a suntan.
Holiday, I think you called that holiday.
Yeah. And then I was sort of came in the 2002 Six Nations. So I was very lucky in my time to come in, and I've got no problem saying I was lucky to come into that squad. And then suddenly we had that unbelievable run. And going into that, I never ever thought I was going to keep getting selected.
I know people say we're lucky a lot in sport, but when it comes down to playing at that level, luck is a small injury might play a part in it, but you've got to put yourself in the shop window. So who was ahead of you at that time leading into that 03 squad? So if you go back to 2002.
Phil Green was around, wasn't he? But I think he was just coming to the end. He got injured. Mark Regan, West, you know, so...
So you were the youngster coming through.
I was the youngster, yeah. It's funny at training sometimes.
But very different style. If you think about how you all play. You play a very different style to that. Phil Greening, for example.
Yeah, it was always a shame, really, that Phil Greening sort of retired, because I think he would have kept me with that edge. You know, perhaps Dorian West and Mark Regan didn't really come against me that much. I didn't want Don to be disrespectful. They were very good hookers, but then the game had changed, like you said, and Phil Greening had brought that extra dynamity to it, whereas I hopefully done what he could do. Perhaps not as fast, but then suddenly overall, like I brought that, you know, extra bit to a hooker, And I think if me and him had kept going together, we'd just made each other even better. And it's just the timing, though. If I had got found the year after, you'd have missed all that.
Yeah.
But it was good.
Simon Hardy,
he told me a good story. He was the line-out coach that got given the job of doom of getting me to learn to throw a ball. My problem was I was ex-basketball player, so I used to shoot in basketballs, and that's what he always used to try and train out of me, because throwing's totally different. But, you know, he actually told me that we went on that tour to America. I came on towards the end of the tour, America A versus England A, at the back row, just to cover because there were so many injuries on that tour. And I just had an absolute blinding 20 minutes. Everything that could go went right. It was just unbelievable. And suddenly, apparently, when we came off the pitch, Clive Wood was there, walked up to Simon Hardy and went, he's starting a hooker in 2002 against Scotland. And if you can't throw, you're fired. And he literally, so from that day, he'd marked me in. So like the likes of you, Josh Luce and that, he'd already got his squads earmarked, and suddenly he was like, that's what we need.
Yeah.
And I found that out afterwards, obviously, and you know, only a couple of years ago, but he literally earmarked me to say, right, he's in against Scotland. And because Simon Hardy used to come knocking on my door at like 7 o'clock in the morning. He lived down in like near Hemel Hempstead Way, and I was up in Northampton. Knock on the door, and I'm like half asleep, like, what's going on? In the front garden, because I had it all set up in the garden for my throwing basketball net and all this sort of stuff. And he used to be throwing me all the time, come up to training, throwing me all the time. I was thinking, why doesn't this bloke get a life? Do you know what I mean?
He didn't want to get the sack.
Exactly. He then found out that he might get the sack if I didn't learn to throw properly. So he's probably close to getting sacked, but not quite sacked.
So you made it through that pre-World Cup build-up, and you were, you know, quite a remarkable difference to the other guys that you mentioned, like Dorian West and Mark Regan that were around at the time. Lee Mears, obviously, you know, significantly shorter than you. And actually, you know, we were probably used to hookers more like that, Brian Moore and the guys that were slightly shorter. But so what was it like? So World Cup final, you are there. You've not been a hooker for that long, for, you know, 2 years, 3 years, really.
2.5 years, yeah.
And all of a sudden, the pressure of the world is on you in the dying moments of a World Cup. And Ben Kay asked you to throw the ball to the back of the line out. How did you feel about that? That's not an easy throw for a hooker, is it? Especially one that's only been playing that position for years.
And I was one in the first half with 100% of the line out. Second half, it just completely... We knew all their calls. They knew all our calls. It's unbelievable. It goes spies and camps and all this sort of stuff. It's hilarious.
Clive used to have the bug detectors out, didn't he?
Debugging stuff. Yeah. And Australia had a helicopter flying above our training sessions, filming our training sessions and stuff.
Yeah.
It's mental. But... you know, it's actually one of the throws I actually like throwing as well. But, you know, it's one of them. You go back through the line. Lawrence, a couple of times, was supposed to be throwing to him. He started running. He was supposed to lift. And he started trying to jump. And things just sort of fell apart. And then suddenly you came on. So I was thinking, oh, here we go.
You were like, thank God for that.
Where's the best place to throw it to Lewis? Where is he always protected? So I threw it straight to his nuts.
So in all fairness, so you watched that back. I've watched that back since. And they had George Smith, who played seven for Australia back then, who was a remarkable player. Obviously, he came over to the Premiership. But, I mean, he was pretty short, number seven. And that ball, when you threw that ball to the back, because none of the Aussies went up, did they? They didn't contest the line-out. Actually, If Smith had jumped, he probably could have got it. I'm doing you a disservice. But that is a huge amount of pressure. I know, because people always ask me, what was it like to have to catch the ball at the end of the line-out? I was like, I didn't think.
Yeah. You got called, you'd done it, and you just sort of get on with it. And, you know, it's one of those things, you know, mentally, you know, my phrase then from Simon Hunter, you're only as good as your next throw. There's no point worrying about what's happened, you know, and you have throws go all over the place, you know, line outs technical, you got bad lifts, bad throws, the opposition read it well. So if you start getting hung up on it, you know, when I first went to hooker, I can remember it was horrendous in games because, like Leon said earlier, I started back row and then they put me a prop for a few months. So I'd learned to scrummage and stuff. That was just horrendous, having my head shoved up my backside for 80 minutes. And then they put me into hooker. And I can remember playing in games where the opposition would kick the ball to us. And they could see it was outside the 22, so they couldn't kick it straight out. Suddenly, we'd kick it back, and I'm thinking, oh, yeah, we'll kick it into their 22. And suddenly, I could see them, and my whole thought process was like, run the ball. Oh, he's kicking it. He's kicking it. Oh, stay in. Oh, no. Oh, it's gone out. Oh, take a quick throw in. Oh, no, I've got to throw the ball now.
Take a quick throw.
Yeah.
Please,
anyone. Yeah. It was just like, and just sort of dreading it at first, the first few months, because I sort of went... From back row prop to hardly thrown at all. And then I got put into the England 21. So I was 20 when I changed to hooker. So I was straight into the England 21s and stuff and fast-tracked in. And you think, oh, here we go, sort of thing. And I can remember just dreading it at first because it was just horrendous at first. And then suddenly, after a while, I just thought, I don't care. Do you know what I mean? It's one of them. I trained and trained and trained for it and just tried my best.
And obviously, everyone talks about Johnny Wilkinson, you know, drop goal, winning the World Cup. But actually, you know, we can, after this little chat, say Simon Hardy had a big part to play in us winning the World Cup, taking you out at 7 a.m. and getting you to practice for 2 years. I mean, that's a remarkable journey. Tom Youngs has done it recently, moving from centre to hooker to play in a World Cup and a Lions tour. That speed of transition was remarkable. But also we can say we won the World Cup because you and me went to cinema the night before, as we had done for every other game of the tournament. Although when we got there that night, the Aussies had shut up shop, hadn't they?
They'd shut everything down around the hotel, hadn't they? I think because they were just out bibbing their routers and all that, like, and trying to keep us awake. So yeah, we go to the cinema like we always do on a Friday. Probably my rounds, because even when it's your round, I end up paying as well.
Things are standard.
Is it? Yeah. Lewis is well known for going to a cinema on a Friday night, suddenly getting there. Oh, it's my round. Getting the card out, going to pay, and going, I can't remember my number. Phones is missus.
That is classic. Neither of you two ever bring your wallets.
Lewis's nickname was Crime at Leicester, because crime doesn't pay. Literally, that's what everyone called him the whole time.
Should we move on?
So we went there, and then, there was like the cleaner was there or something like that.
You ended up paying. Actually, I think I paid.
No, I ended up paying. I ended up paying. So I ended up paying equivalent of, I don't know, about £100, because it was like our good luck charm, wasn't it? It's like, we've got to watch a film.
We had to pay it to the...
We paid the bloke, so we paid...
What was he? He was like the film, the projectionist.
Yeah, in there, and ended up paying like £100, like not Aussie dollars, £100 for him to open the screen for us. And then he was that bloody cheeky, he even turned around and went, oh no, you got to pay for your tickets as well.
So he had a great night out. It was just me and you.
Do you remember the film?
School of Rock.
School of Rock.
I mean, a proper motivational number.
Pre World Cup movie.
Yeah. But mate, that's the reason Jack Black and those kids in School of Rock, they want us to
World Cup.
So we're there. So I was, it was one of those things. You pay the money. It was our good luck ritual. I weren't really into it that much, I must admit, before I met Lewis. But then it was one of them, we've got to do it. And then suddenly it becomes part of your routine.
Right, so we had those. I mean, you had remarkable eyes, and we played together in that 03 game, and it was just incredible. But after that, some big lows. I mean, we have to talk about you breaking your neck and retiring at 28.
Yeah.
I mean, so to talk us through that. So, you know, obviously having won a World Cup in 2003, all of a sudden, 3 years later, 2.5 years later, you're having to make a life-changing decision to stop doing the one sport that you love.
Well, it sort of just happened overnight. I played Barrett and got like a trip tackle by Serge Betson and hit my head, and I carried on playing for about 10-15 minutes, but it was the physio that spotted it. I went for a line out and I held the ball up, and it must have been like muscle memory now. I moved the ball, next minute the ball was in front of me, and he seen me sort of like, what's that all about, you know, and the ball was in front of my face, but my arm had gone and I just couldn't feel things. And suddenly the physio came running on, like, you've got to come off. So it's, fine. Just thought, I'd never really been injured before. I popped my ribs, knees and stuff like that, medial ligament, but nothing really bad as such. And then went for the scan, didn't think anything. On the Monday evening, I can remember going there and the specialist sitting down and going, oh, everything all right? And I was like, yeah, and he was just being really nice to me. And I was like, and he went, just so you know, I don't know how to put it, but you can't play rugby anymore. And I was like, what do you mean? And he showed me the scan and where the scan had gone. I'd popped the disc out, and luckily I'd had two bulges in that disc, so it was sort of heart-shaped. Whereas if it hadn't had those bulges, it would have severed my spinal cord. So it was sort of lucky. It sort of sat in between the...
So the broken gap. The broken bit of vertebrae.
Yeah, it was just two bulges. So bulge. So it was sort of like that. So rather than it being round and
I love flat, the fact that you're
painting on radio.
Yeah. It's doing a great visual in here. It's going to paint a slightly harder picture for those people listening. Yeah.
And then if it had been the normal shape it should have been, it would have gone through the spinal cord. Wow. So I can remember going, and one of the bits went down to see Rick Nelson, who'd done Jason Leonard, Phil Vickery, and Trevor Wooden's neck.
He was the neck specialist.
Yeah, he was the neck specialist down in Bristol. And I can remember seeing him, and he sort of looked at the scan, and he says, fine. I said, and just as I was leaving, I said, but it's really weird. I said, and he said, what? I said, I just, when I need, I don't even know, but I just need to go to the toilet like all the time. And literally, if I'm not next to a toilet, it's too late. And suddenly he went, right, booked me straight in. He didn't even listen to anything else. And apparently that's a sign of like the real damage to the spinal cord. So it was like, oh, okay. And luckily, well, it was just bruised.
Yeah.
So then, yeah, he put me in. It was amazing though, because I went in on the Tuesday. My mate Simon Heifer came down, stayed with me, Gruy and Mirzy, and everyone came and see me the next morning. I left on the Wednesday.
Yeah.
So literally, I was only overnight. I expected to be in a big cage and everything like this.
Yeah.
Nothing at all. I literally went from the Tuesday morning, not being able to move my neck very well, to Wednesday, moving it. No pain whatsoever. The only pain where they'd put the old thing down my throat to breathe when you join the operation. And it was brilliant, because I can remember laying there in bed, and Simon Heifer, his brother Ali Heifer, is the coach at Exeter, and you know, we lived together for years, we're close. I can remember sitting there like, oh, can you pass me some water, please? He passed me some water, and then suddenly like it was like, oh, and he was like feeding me, and I was like sort of there like, oh yeah, I can't move. And then one of the lads brought in a pizza. I stood straight up and then took a piece of pizza, and he was like, all day I've been feeding you, wiping your brow and all that. Like, I was like, yeah, it was quite nice though.
That's it. I mean, that's an enormous thing to overcome. You're at 28, you're still a sort of prime of your playing career. You know, how did you mentally cope with that?
How many people around in sport had broken their neck around that time that we're aware of? So you point to people
Andy,
who that's
like Andy Blythe.
Andy
maybe
Blythe,
at that
he broke his before that, didn't he? So you look at people, and you must have felt really lucky that you had that initial bulge in your neck, so that it wasn't
like,
game over.
Like you said, though, it was one of them things as well where I'd had enough of rugby at the time. Northampton had broke me. Everything going on there.
Why did Northampton break you? Because I remember you being, you know, Saints through and through. You came through the academy. They earmarked you. What happened there?
I was captain there and stuff. And then they had a big influx of like the New Zealand players and stuff like that. And there was a big falling out. A bit sort of, not childish, but just change of way clubs are run and stuff. You know, it was that new age of stuff. And I was perhaps a bit too old school for it. And it was like my home club, so it was all changing. So then I'd thought I'd done enough, so I'd signed to go to Brive. And then I had a good meeting in the Crillon, the hotel in Paris, with the owner, Daniel de Richburg, who that day had just become a billionaire because he'd brought Service Air and all his other businesses. And he's...
Good time to meet him.
Yeah, exactly. So we're sitting down, and I can remember we're sitting there, and Brive were third from bottom, but they had a couple of big games coming up. And it looked like they were going to get relegated. And I just sort of had enough of everything. And I said to him, if you're prepared to put all your money in, because he said, look, do you want a clause where if we get relegated, you don't have to sign for us? I said, no. I said, if you keep putting your money in, I'll come and it'll be a whole new project for me and that, and just to get out and things. And this was 2 weeks before the Brits game. And then suddenly the Brits game came. Done my neck, and I had to phone him up. I said, I can't sign for you. He was like, oh, but why? You know. And he said, well, I said, well, I broke my neck. And then suddenly he said, phoned me back about half hour later, or got his PA to, and his PA said, look, Daniel wants to reward you for what you've done. He wants to give you a job, part of his company, and come down and still be part of the Brief. And, you know, like I said, I spent 3 good years at Brief, you know, rebuilding there, and quite proud of what we've done there. You went from, you know, from being relegated, or close to being relegated, favourites, up into the Heineken Cup with, you know, Andy Goo, Jamie Noon, and all players like that we brought to the club.
And so not long after that, I remember seeing you in 2007 at the World Cup when we went out, and you were...
148 kilos.
You were 104. You were, I mean, a beast. I mean, you're a beast of a bloke anyway. But then you decided to come back. You came back.
Yeah, well, I see. Watching the 2007, I sort of just thought I had unfinished business. I thought I was happy when I finished, but then suddenly when I started looking, I thought, you know, I can do this. And I was coaching some of the players at Brive and doing something. I thought, I can do this again. Tried to see the specialist in England. They wouldn't sign me off to come back because the ball and socket joint I'd had in my neck, no one had really played with it, so they didn't know how strong it was. They knew for real, like normal life, it'd be fine, but for sporting, they weren't too sure. So I found a French one and he signed me off. But then suddenly, I tried to play a game when I was 148 kilos and suddenly thought, no, this isn't right. And then Laurent Senn, who was the coach, the manager, he said, I've got the bloke for you. And he was the ex-marathon runner for France, Vincent Four, his name was. And I lived with him for 6 weeks practically, and he just killed me. And I lost, what was it, 28 kilos in just under 6 weeks. And it was different because rather than just losing the weight, I had to build muscle up as well. And probably the best shape I've ever been in.
To go from someone who's fallen out of love with the sport, completely fallen out of love with the sport, but you're still coaching it, to then decide, do you know what, I want to put the boots back on. Did you think that that point when you're actually going to risk coming back and, you know, the whole insurance thing and everything else, did you plan on getting back to being where you were before, or were you just coming back to play the game that you used to love?
No, I wanted to play for England again.
Okay, all right.
Now, I'll tell you what the big thing, I finished on 40, first time, 47, 48 caps. And when you sort of play, get through, when you get your 50th cap, you get like this little mushroom. And I always thought, if you get to 50 mushrooms...
You should probably explain that the mushroom is a really nice silver display cap.
Expensive
on a,
thing
on a little
that England put together.
Not an actual mushroom.
But I thought, to be like an England sort of great, you've got to, in those times, you've got to get to 50 caps. Also, Keith Picton, I spoke about earlier, when I started playing, he'd never asked for anything, but he said to me, I'm just happy, I'll come and watch you when you win your 50th cap. So to me, nice. In the back of my mind... And that was my big thing, was to get to 50. So I was, like I said, I was on 48, and I just thought, this is what I've got to do.
You then obviously got back. We played in another World Cup together in 2011, which we won't go into now because we're running out of time. But, you know, there was so much to talk about in there. But for you alone, just getting back to playing, let alone getting back in that England side, reaching your 50th cap, I mean, what a milestone. But then you had to retire again after the World Cup. I think you had 40-odd games for, no, maybe less for Leeds, and then one game for Wasps.
Yeah.
And then you broke your neck again?
Yeah.
While the same thing happened?
Well, no, totally different. The back of my front, just the front, snapped the nerve and done the spine again. So, you know, it was one of those things. I was financially secure after the first injury, but I decided to take the money to France and then...
Pay it all back.
Yeah, and then, of course, the euro and the pound flipped, so I ended up paying everything I ever had back to play the first time. Well, the second time when I came
so
back.
So you paid back all the insurance money you got when you were retired at 28.
Yeah.
You got obviously a good payout, yeah, because you're a young man. You paid all that money back so you could come and play.
With money on top of that, yeah, because I lost it in the currency exchange.
Wow. So, I mean, that is a big
And
hit.
I can remember one thing. I can remember I got a story that John Wells, who I immense respect for, hard as anything, I'm glad hopefully I earned his respect towards you. He actually turned around to someone and said, oh, he's only back in the squad for the money. I felt like I wanted to kick him in the teeth.
Wells, he said that. Yeah. John Wells obviously was the England forwards coach at the time.
Yeah.
And particularly, he's a northerner, isn't he? Straight talking, blunt blokes. But, oh, man, yeah. I think
he... And I've got great respect for him, do you know what I mean? And yeah, hopefully I turned it around because I got selected and stuff. So, yeah, so that sort of ruined me as such. Financially, but will I change it? No, I don't think I would. You know what I mean? There's nothing better than standing at Twickenham, you know, singing the national anthem and just playing there. Do you know what I mean? How many people get the opportunity to do it? That's why I looked at it. You know, I've come from nothing. You get nothing and then suddenly you can earn it again some other way. And that's what, you know, we'll do. You know, I got an insurance policy again the second time getting injured, but I gave that back up because I wanted to go back to work. You know, it was one of them that could keep paying you, but, you know, it just didn't suit me because being 33 and stuff like that and not working and that, it's so just not me.
Some people are probably very surprised to know that you've gone through that financial struggle purely for the love of the game. You've actually paid back all the money that you had that supported your retirement or that was supposed to support your retirement.
Yeah.
And then you've had to retire again despite having come back for the love of the game. And the financial struggles that come with that, trying to figure out where you... Because you were a builder, essentially, before you came into it.
Yeah, I've got no education. I've got nothing, really. I got kicked out, like you said, just before the exams and stuff. So, you know, it's one of them. But that's what rugby gave me. I was a proper mute, as you say. But, you know, being with rugby, it puts you in the circles and the opportunities to meet people and bring you on as a better human. And, you know, open my eyes. I've travelled around the world. You know, I've gave talks to, like, management of O2. You know, you go in there and you... Like I said, it opens your eyes of a new way of living. And, you know, I look at my kids now and think, one thing I always want to do, I had the opportunity, I was being an apprenticeship carpenter, and because rugby went professional, it was sort of gun against your head time. Are you going to come on board? But you can't do both. And it's one of them, like, what do I do? Because at the time, it was just sugar daddies putting money in.
Yeah.
And it could have, after 2 years, they could have gone, actually, this ain't working. And then I've had to start my apprenticeship all over again.
Do you think there's enough done then? You know, if you look in hindsight, do you think there's enough support for players? I know obviously Leon works with Switch the Play now and looks at how athletes transition and how to support them transitioning. Do you think for guys of our era, actually, there's still a place for that? And, you know, looking back, is there more that you could have?
Yeah, because I think I was one of the first sort of players, the first to get into the professional game, like at that sort of age, sort of just finishing school straight in. So the lads before us all had jobs and stuff like that. And sometimes, you know, people look at it when you you know, there's a couple of players that played in Northampton. They had jobs. Suddenly they went full-time rugby and then they weren't in the first team as much. So they dropped down a division, got a job, also got paid to play rugby at the weekends. So if anything, they were happy with that because they were getting to play rugby rather than holding pads all the time. But then their transition into afterlife was a lot easier. Whereas that was the whole point when I signed for WAS after the World Cup 2011. I was going to come to London, sort of try and get open your network more, play 3 years, perhaps not international rugby if I didn't get picked, but then just enjoy my rugby, but then also sort of try and get a life afterwards. And
so you're planning for that? That's what I was going to ask you that. So you were planning for what comes after you finished?
Yeah, because I thought I'd learn after the first injury.
Yeah.
So then suddenly I see
what did that look like back then, if you remember? What did you think? Moving to WAS is a good strategic decision to go to London because that's where lots
happen. Yeah, well, one, Sean Edwards was there, so I really wanted to play under him because I heard he's a bit of a lunatic, but he's one of these coaches that I'd love to play under.
Yeah.
So the week I signed, a week later, he left. So I'm not sure hopefully I didn't have anything to do with that, but apparently he sort of fell out with WAS there. So that was a bit of a shocker. But then, you know, and Dai Young was brilliant down there, you know, and I had a week off after the World Cup, came into training, and then suddenly just thought, this is brilliant. Now I'm down in London, moved to Ealing, get myself settled, and then just done my neck again in training.
So what were you thinking? What were you thinking was going to come after you finished playing? So you moved to London because you thought of, you already had that in the corner of your mind.
Yeah.
I need to think about what comes next.
Yeah, I thought I had the 3 years, because I had a three-year contract. So I had 3 years of thinking, right, I'll give myself a year, going out, networking, see what opportunities might arise. And then if I needed to study or whatever, that will give me 2 years to study and go into that role of...
Oh, okay, so you didn't have a specific thing.
Going down to London, the bucket's a lot bigger. And then also, you know, when I was in Northampton, I used to do a lot of work, come down into London and stuff like, because it is a great opportunity and of networking and seeing people. But then suddenly, you know, that sort of got cut pretty short. And that time it did knock me, because suddenly I was like, I've got nothing now. I've got no cash. I've got nothing really. I had the insurance policy as such that kept me going for a bit. But then, you know, then that stopped as soon as I started working.
So what one thing that has changed a lot since our day, because I know that we had the same sort of dilemma, we're being paid to be rugby players, not to be students or anything else. You're all in or all out.
Yeah.
That's not the case nowadays. There's a lot more emphasis on dual careers or doing stuff outside. There's still scope to do more, because if you go back to that time, remember, you put yourself in a young man's shoes at 20, all you want to do is play. You want to play Saturday to Saturday. And you'll do those other things because if you've got to do them, but you care about Saturday to Saturday. So I think the game's changed quite a lot.
That's why I like Saracens, if I'm honest. Saracens are doing an amazing job with the players and stuff. One, they're winning on the pitch, away from that as well, you know, they're setting them up in business, they're giving them the opportunities. And I think that definitely works, you know, use it while you can. I just think, you know, Nigel Ray, I don't care what people say, I'd hail him as a hero. You know, he stuck through that club through thick and thin, the amount of cash he's put through that, amount of money he's put in charity, and how many young men has he made their life better, you know. And sometimes you sort of tip your cap and say, you know, for me, he is an absolute hero of rugby.
Mate, listening to your transition has been fascinating. I'm sure a lot of people have no idea that, you know, you've been through all those challenges, let alone two broken necks, you know, the financial struggles and all those bits and pieces. But it'd be really amiss of us not to talk about the current England setup, because you played in that World Cup side. You played with lots of successful teams.
You know, looking at the warm-up games, I think, you know, England are looking good. They are looking good.
Could they win it? I know we're a long way out.
I think, you know, everyone's talking about it. It's the most open World Cup there's been. There is, you know, you've got the Wales, even Australia. I don't think Australia can string two wins against in a row. But they can certainly put out one big one this time. And, you know, you wouldn't want to play them in the semi or a quarter final. You know, New Zealand are obviously always going to be there. But my sort of favourites outside of England is South Africa. And, you know, they're looking very strong. Now they've, you know, brought in the players that play abroad as well. That's just, once again, South Africans, when they were there, they were just thought about South Africa. And now they've picked the players that have played abroad. They've played all the different international players week in, week out, going back with their experience, and they're bringing it to the squad. And you can see the way they're playing. Before, it used to be very hard. If you man up against them, you got a good chance of beating them because they didn't have a plan B. Whereas now you see it, they play with great speed, great physicality still, but then also, you know, the way they're allowed to express themselves. Whereas in the past, you know, you hear of the way they were coached was very much, there's a man in front of you, you run into him. And if he tackles you next time, you just run harder. And that was their whole philosophy of rugby. So, you know, England can combat that. Our biggest weakness, I think, is game plan. When we're in tight games, I still don't believe sometimes we've got the leadership to get us through that. I would have taken Wigglesworth as a scrum half. Purely like, remember Mike Catt in 03 got called up right at the very end. Didn't really play much of a part, really, until the quarterfinals against Wales, where he got brought on, not for tins, and was just phenomenal.
So I think we're in agreement that we all think that England could potentially win.
Yeah.
So let's fast forward ourselves to the day after the World Cup final. So when we're sat here now, and England have lost. Where are they lacking? What made them lose the World Cup final?
I think their scrum halves didn't put them in the position they need to, and they just lost their head a bit at crucial times. You know, they still give away silly penalties when they just don't need to. That's our biggest thing. When we're building the pressure, you know, there's times when, you know, we're over the ball too much and stuff, where it's just, they're going to kick the ball back to us. Don't give away a silly penalty and release the pressure. And that's what seems to happen at the moment. Key, even if it's not in our 22, when it's in the opposition, you know, we've got them under pressure. We're going to get the ball back. Next minute, stupid penalties.
So discipline. So you think discipline would be the reason why England don't win the World Cup?
Can be, yeah.
Tomo, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming in, mate.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your honesty and reflections on a life and career. If you've enjoyed what you've heard today, then please rate and review, subscribe on Apple Pods and Spotify or wherever you go to listen to your podcasts. And Leon probably should hand it over to you for the final. You've always got something interesting to say at the end. Well, I say interesting, boring, but
I've got something to say. I one thing I miss as an athlete, and I say athlete, I mean rugby player, is feedback. Because on the pitch, if you drop the ball, which I didn't do very often,
that's a lie. Constantly dropped.
But if you drop the ball, you get feedback. You get feedback from the crowd, you get feedback from your teammates and the coaches.
With booze.
We all crave feedback. So please feedback to us which bits you liked, which bits you'd like us to talk about in the future. But give us your feedback. It'll be great and muchly appreciated.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.